Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Mason Adams. This week, the Seeing Hand Association brings together people who are visually impaired to learn the craft of chair caning.
Some days I'd come here and just cry. And then you meet these people and you hear all their stories and you see what they've had to overcome and that they smile and they laugh every day. It got me out of my funk. It brought my confidence back.
Corporate greed has been gobbling up newspapers for years. Now, some of the same companies are taking a bite out of mobile home parks.
To them, a business is just a way to extract cash. There's no interest in journalism. There's no interest in providing housing. These things that are essential to our society.
And as the Mountain Valley Pipeline nears completion, some people who live near it say government officials are ignoring their concerns about pollution.
And I'm just furious. I'm furious at politics. It's almost like, well, we feel like we were sacrificed.
You'll hear these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Mason Adams. A lot of folks in Appalachia grew up with caned chairs in the house. You know the kind, a wooden frame with a woven seat. Maybe your parents or grandparents had a set in the kitchen. You don't see the old cane chairs as much as you used to. Cane doesn't last forever. It breaks down and needs to be replaced. Few people know how to do that or where to go to fix their chairs. So a lot of them are discarded or thrown away. But they don't have to be. At a workshop in Wheeling, West Virginia, a community of skilled workers repair old chairs and show that not everything that looks broken has to be thrown out. Folkways reporter Clara Hazlett brings us this story.
Super duper tight, under, over, super duper tight.
Bianca Miller is standing eye level with a wooden chair that's been placed on top of a table. Now, usually chairs go under the table, and usually chairs are for sitting. But if you sat on this chair, you'd fall right through. The seat is gone.
Under, over, under, over.
Bianca's weaving a new seat onto the chair's empty wooden frame. She's using a material called rush, which looks almost like a long, thick shoestring. It's brittle and needs a good long soak before you can weave with it.
Say a little prayer, because I like my fingers.
As she weaves, Bianca pulls at the rush to tighten it.
Super tight, super duper tight. Make sure your fingers turn the darkest red they can possibly turn. And if you lose the first few layers of skin, it's okay. It's all for the chair.
There you go.
Bianca canes by memory, touch, and whatever level of vision she has that day.
With my disease, I never know if I'm going to wake up with vision or not.
She was diagnosed with uveitis in 2020. It's an inflammatory eye disease.
And in the process of getting treatment, I ended up going totally blind for 10 months.
Bianca eventually regained some vision, but it's unpredictable.
Today I have floaters and flashes, and it's a little bit cloudy, almost as if you're looking through a lava lamp, because you just never know what to expect.
Although Bianca's sight isn't guaranteed day to day, it's not really necessary to do this job, and to do it well. In fact, everyone in this workshop has limited visual ability. It's a nonprofit called Seeing Hand. They provide employment and specialized services for folks that are blind or visually impaired. Employees are trained in a variety of skills, like refurbishing fire extinguishers, making and restoring mops, caning chairs.
You know, the fire extinguishers, the chairs, the mops, the brooms. It all makes sure we have a job. It's job security. There's one, two, three, four, five. There's six of us that do the chairs.
Bianca came to Seeing Hand about 2 years ago.
I kind of forgot about this place until my mother had reminded me that my grandfather was here. He had went blind all of a sudden in his early 30s, which is when I went blind.
It's been years now since Bianca's grandfather worked here, but Seeing Hand is still around, marking nearly a century of providing services and support in the community. Mike Cunningham started at Seeing Hand last year.
So I work 3 days a week. It's first time I've been working since 2012. Before this job, my activities outside of the house were 45 minutes at the grocery store. basically was stuck in a house for, 10 years.
Mike's totally blind in his left eye. The vision in his right eye is slightly better, but not great.
I have zero straight lines. Every straight line is curved. So it's more of a distortion than it is, blindness. So it's a definite impairment.
Mike is weaving with cane, a material that's thinner and more delicate than rush.
All right, let's see.
Following an intricate pattern, he carefully threads a strip of cane under, over, under, over.
Mike is newer, and he doubts himself a little more than he should, because he does a beautiful job, and I shouldn't say that, because every time I say good job or wow, it looks really good, something always happens. So, Mike, terrible. Yeah, burn it.
Mike's nearly done with this chair. He says it's been his hardest yet.
A lot of the time you talk to the chair. If it's not going very easy, you don't say very nice things.
Sometimes caning can be frustrating. I stick my tongue out sometimes. Because there's spots where it's hard to do.
That's Janine Schmidt. Her work table is right across from Mike's.
There you go. Here's a cloth.
Okay. Thank you.
You are welcome.
Janine is 81. She learned how to cane over 40 years ago, before experiencing any vision loss. These days, she largely relies on muscle memory.
You almost can feel if it's right. It's like second nature. Your fingers kind of are on automatic. This is a chair that's probably 100 years old.
Around these parts, 100 years old is pretty average. Bianca shows me a row of chairs that are patiently waiting their turn to undergo chair surgery. There's an old rocker covered in dust.
Yeah, that one's going to be really hard to do.
There's one with a fist-sized hole right through the cane.
I love the dirty and the ugly and the, unique. It's absolutely beautiful. We get to work on them. You know how old these chairs are?
Most chairs here are brought in by customers from around the Ohio Valley. But the chairs themselves come from all over.
Some of them are stamped on, Italy or Germany, and some of them are stamped at, Indiana or New York. And you wonder, okay, how did this even come about? You know what I mean? I don't know. My brain can go on forever. And it's just a chair, for gosh sakes. I mean.
Before working here at Seeing Hand, Bianca was a bus driver.
The bus's name was Twinkles. I love that job. I miss that job.
When she started to regain some vision, her goal was to get her commercial driver's license back.
I had to come to a realization. That'll never happen. Sorry. I loved that job. But Seeing Hand has brought that back. When I first started working here, I was depressed. I gained a lot of weight. I was on a lot of meds. I was up and down, back and forth. Some days I'd come here and just cry. Shouldn't have even came. And then you meet these people and you hear all their stories and you see what they've had to overcome and that they smile and they laugh every day. It got me out of my funk. It brought my confidence back.
Most people have really no idea what certain things can do to you when you're vision impaired. And it's nice to have people, if you explain to them, they know what you mean. And they're like brothers and sisters.
So this place is so much more than just, paycheck.
This is my second home. Let's put it like that.
Got it. Janine is nearly finished with her chair. So is Mike. When they're done, the chairs will be sent downstairs to join the ranks of the other finished chairs, all freshly stained and tightly caned. And in a few weeks, Bianca's chair will be done too, repaired and ready for another 100 years. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Clara Hazlett.
Passing on traditional knowledge happens in different ways. In Clara's story, it's a community of people sharing what they know with one another, hand to hand and side by side. Other folks have to find a different guide. Shane Foster is an optometrist in Ohio and an avid quilter. Quilting had been in his family for generations, but it was dying out. To learn this traditional craft, Foster chose a way that's a little less traditional. In 2022, Folkways reporter Liz Paul reported this story.
Shane Foster is one of those folks who always had strong memories of quilts during his childhood.
It's just something that was always in my family. My great-grandmothers on my mom's side both were quilters. They had done it for years, decades, and I always had a quilt on my bed growing up. So I just assumed that's what everybody had. I didn't, you know, when I grew up and learned that there were like down comforters and things like this, I had never really experienced that because we just always used a quilt that was had been passed down from one of our great-grandmothers.
As time passed, the matriarchs and Shane's family had stopped making quilts, either through lack of interest or passing away, and Shane realized that the tradition might die out within his family.
I've said for years that I wanted someone in our family to start quilting.
But no one did, until Shane himself contracted COVID in 2021. Shane recovered well, with the exception of some lingering post-COVID symptoms, like anxiety and high blood pressure. His family doctor suggested he find something that would allow him to de-stress. So he began the journey of learning how to quilt. There was just one problem. Shane had no guidance from his grandmothers to teach him their craft. The solution?
Welcome to my channel. Today's video, we are going to make your first quilt.
YouTube.
I did watch some YouTube videos to figure out what were the techniques. It really helped me through it. And I think in a way, it's like having somebody there showing you how to do this.
And I'm gonna line up my edges with that line.
Like if I had learned from my grandmother or my great grandmother saying, no, this is how you do this.
So there's no need to backstitch with piecing, quilting.
It's on demand, and it's in a way that is easily accessed by anyone.
Shane's story got me wondering, if you learn an art from YouTube, is it still folk art?
We always use new technologies. If a new technology emerges, it is against human nature to not wonder if maybe it could make your life a little bit easier.
Zoe Van Buren is the Folklife Director at the North Carolina Arts Council, and she spent a lot of time thinking about the ways people pass on traditional practices.
It's very romantic to kind of think that every tradition bearer has or should come to their practice through the same route, and that route always has to start with somebody in their immediate community or family kind of sitting them down and having that knee-to-knee teaching moment.
Zoe says today's practitioners grew up with the internet at their fingertips. She says they'll eventually become our elder culture keepers.
We had a very cool project at the North Carolina Arts Council that is ongoing, but it was the Millennial Traditional Artists Project, and one of the big questions was, what do we do for and with the digital generation, and how does the access to digital technology, to mass communications, to YouTube, to social media, change the way that we talk about traditional arts and how they're taught, how they're learned? Some of the anxiety around using YouTube in a traditional learning context is, What are you not learning? And as folklorists, you know, we are more interested in sort of the conversation around it rather than coming up with a definitive answer itself. And the answer isn't the thing that matters. The thing that matters is that we are worried about our culture. We're worried about our practice. We're worried about knowledge. We're worried about what the next generation knows. So it doesn't matter if we land on one definitive answer. What matters is that we care enough to sort of debate it.
And besides, the digital world has strong connections with the real world. Just look at Shane Foster. He learned how to quilt from YouTube videos, but that knowledge has allowed him to connect with a real-life quilter, his great-grandmother. She passed away many years ago, but Shane's now working with fabric that she cut out for a quilt that she never finished.
And now I'm taking those pieces and I'm honoring her memory and doing it in the way that she intended, but also putting my own twist on it by using some fabrics that I chose. And so I did come together with this amalgam of different fabrics to make it kind of a combination work between her and me.
Now that Shane has many projects under his belt, he's looking forward to exploring the quilting medium as a source of artistic expression. All, of course, with a nod to his teachers, both great-grandma and YouTube. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Liz Paul.
Those first two stories are part of our Folkways reporting project, which covers arts and culture in our region. You can find dozens more Folkway stories at our website, wvpublic.org. Coming up, a David and Goliath story about a mobile home park in southern West Virginia.
I was very inspired by what these tenants are doing, and they are not giving up. They are still fighting, and I believe, you know, these are their homes.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Mason Adams.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University, offering 31 bachelor-level degrees and 6 master-level degrees for students of any age. More information at concord.edu.
After a new owner took control of a mobile home park in Mercer County, West Virginia, the people who lived there noticed immediate changes. Rents went up, and it seemed like the new owner was doing less to take care of problems like broken windows or even a sewage leak. So one resident started looking into exactly who this new owner was. What she found became the subject of a story in Voices of Monterey Bay, an online publication from California. Julie Reynolds reported the story. She recently spoke with me from a van in the Mojave Desert, north of Quartzsite, Arizona. Julie Reynolds, thank you so much for coming on Inside Appalachia to speak with us.
You're very welcome. It's my pleasure.
I think you are the first person I have interviewed who has been in a minivan sitting in the desert.
Most likely, but you know, the sound quality is pretty good.
This story you have, it's headlined, "The Davids in Appalachia Fighting the Monterey Bay Area's News Goliath." This story sprawls across the U.S., but let's start where the story does, in Mercer County, West Virginia. So can you tell us about Elkview Estates, which is the property at the beginning, and sort of what starts the chain of events there?
Sure. So Elkview Estates, according to one of the tenants there, Valeria Steele, was a very nice mobile home park, manufactured home community, until about 2021, when a very mysterious entity bought the park. Tenants didn't know who these owners were. They were told to send their rent checks to a place in Englewood, New Jersey, to a man named Tom Del Bosco, and various other entities at different times. The rent checks kind of went to a lot of different places. Valeria is kind of a citizen journalist, and she started investigating and digging into public records and connected the dots to see that the entity that bought her mobile home park was an affiliate of the same investment firm that had taken over a huge swath of American newspapers. And she found my reporting about this company, Alden Global Capital, and its related business, Smith Management, and connected the dots and saw that the company that bought her mobile home park, Homes of America, and also bought 5 others in Mercer County, was actually a business affiliate of Alden Global Capital, the same company that was known for destroying local newspapers.
And now the residents of Elkview Estate are suing Homes of America. What's the latest on what's happening there?
So a pro bono law firm called Mountain State Justice decided to support the tenants in all 6 Mercer County mobile home parks that were owned by Homes of America. And they have filed several lawsuits, including one that's a possible class action. They're waiting to see if they get certified. And the reason I call them the Davids fighting Goliath is because they've actually had some successes. They were able to stop rent increases. They were able to halt some evictions. And we're talking about when Homes of America took over, rents just shot up. I mean, Valeria's went up $300 a month, from $550 to $850 a month. Some went up 60%. And we're talking about many people in these parks are on very limited income, Social Security, veterans benefits, and can't even fathom affording that kind of rent increase. At the same time, they're stuck there if they're renting the land, but they own their mobile home, the costs of moving the home are prohibitive. You know, it can be in the tens of thousands of dollars to move one of these mobile homes. So many of them just left. You know, the parks now have a huge vacancy rate. Valeria has told me that there's been sewage leakages, that there's overgrown grass, broken windows, and all of this took place since Homes of America took over the park. The lawsuits, like I said, have had some successes. To me, that was very inspiring because journalists have been trying to figure out how to save their local newspapers and so far have been kind of befuddled. You know, they've been fighting back and they've had a few small victories against Alden Global Capital. But this was kind of stunning and inspiring to see these tenants organizing themselves. They went out with cell phones, shot photos of the sewage leaks and things like that, and put together a case.
What is the latest with their case at the moment?
So they're kind of on hold for a little bit. The judge handling the cases, the main ones, retired in December, and the new judge has not been appointed. So they had been in the middle of a process of submitting some motions because Homes of America was not complying with the court orders. They were not supplying what's called discovery, which is all the documents showing what's going on. And so there is a motion still pending to order them to provide this discovery. They've been ordered once and they ignored that order. And now they're waiting for a new order to, you know, have some consequences because they're absolutely ignoring the court's order on this. So they're in a holding pattern right now. And we shall see what happens next, but they're still fighting.
You know, here in Appalachia, we're seeing sort of both of these trends play out in real time with different companies buying up mobile home parks and in a lot of cases raising rent and making it harder for residents to live there. At the same time, we're seeing increasing numbers of newspapers acquired by corporate owners who are appear to be stripping down the paper for parts. How does Alden bring these stories together? And how did you make these connections?
It was pretty easy because I'm a public documents nerd. So once I started looking at the deeds for these mobile home parks, I recognized the names. I recognized the address in Englewood, New Jersey. I knew that was Smith Management. That's the firm of Randall Smith, the co-founder of Alden Global Capital. I saw names of Alden executives on all kinds of documents, acquisition papers, permits. And then even Valeria showed me a check that was cashed by an Alden affiliate. It was literally a fund set up by Alden, completely unrelated to Homes of America. They kind of play very loose and sloppy with all these business entities. There's a lot of overlap. A lot of the same players are involved in them. So I recognize the names from many of the newspaper documents. What was most disturbing was an entity, let's see, what was it called? Tribune. I believe Tribune Finance, MHP, LLC, something along those lines. That raised my hackles because Alden had recently acquired Tribune Publishing. And I have been trying to follow that trail to see if Alden actually extracted money from the Tribune newspapers to buy these mobile home parks. The name of that entity certainly makes it look like that. And it's not out of Alden's wheelhouse because they actually did the same thing with the newspaper chain I worked for, Media News Group. They extracted hundreds of millions of dollars, used that money to buy unrelated businesses that they profited from, and meanwhile, the papers were languishing. We literally had leaky roofs. We had no hot water in the building, and Alden just stopped paying bills, stopped doing maintenance, exactly the same activities they're doing in these mobile home parks. To them, a business is just a way to extract cash. There's no interest in journalism. There's no interest in providing housing. These things that are essential to our society, companies like Alden do not take that into consideration. It's just a spreadsheet in their offices, and they find ways to extract the maximum profit and provide the least amount of service because that's what costs money.
This twin dynamic of corporations pushing people out of housing or making it harder to live where they live and stripping down newspapers, They're both pretty bleak. Where do you find hope in all this?
I find hope in Mercer County, West Virginia. I was very inspired by what these tenants are doing, and they are not giving up. They are still fighting, and I believe, you know, these are their homes. This is the one thing, you know, that you can claim is yours and the hold on to, and it gives you some sense of security. And they are not letting go. They are tenacious. The cases are still wending their way through the courts. They've, like I said, they have had some successes, and just the fact that they were able to halt the rent increases is a dramatic victory. And I think the hundreds of mobile home parks around the country that are going through this same situation, probably thousands, can look to Mercer County and take some inspiration and study those cases and see where they've been able to have these successes. I mean, I'm just very inspired. I think journalists, I recommend, that's what I wrote about. I recommend journalists look at them and study, you know, how are they able to get this kind of success? Because if it's not illegal, what Alden is doing, it is certainly unethical. It's immoral. In many cases, they have just completely ignored permitting processes, things like that. And so that's where these tenants are able to catch them in the act and find, hey, you are not meeting the requirements to even get a permit to operate this business. And the court said, hey, that's true. Let's do something about this. Okay, you can't keep charging extra rent until you fix these things. And in fact, everything that I'm told by the attorneys handling the case, that everything they have fixed has been because of a court order.
It's pretty cool that a reporter from all the way across the country is still tracking these legal proceedings in West Virginia. Julie Reynolds, thank you so much for your work, and thanks for coming on and speaking with us on Inside Appalachia.
Oh, you're very welcome, and it's my pleasure, and both my parents are from Appalachia, so I have roots in Eastern Kentucky.
That was reporter Julie Reynolds. We'll link her story on our website, wvpublic.org. Appalachia connects to a wide variety of musical traditions, including opera. Mary Cardwell Dawson founded the National Negro Opera Company in Pittsburgh in 1941. Dawson grew up in Madison County, North Carolina, and studied music at prestigious schools in Boston and Chicago. She went on to train hundreds of young African Americans to sing opera. Dawson's achievements in the face of discrimination were recently recognized in an exhibition at the Charlotte Museum of History. WFAE's Gwendolyn Glenn spoke with the museum's CEO about Dawson.
The National Negro Opera Company was the first commercially successful black opera house in the country, playing music like that in the background. A few others lasted for only a single production or a few runs before closing. But Dawson's tenacity led to more than two decades of stage productions in New York, Chicago, Pittsburgh, Washington, D.C., and other cities. Her niece, Barbara Edwards Lee, talks about Dawson's legacy in a documentary by Pittsburgh PBS station WQED.
Oh, Aunt Mary was delightful. She was quite a musician. She could do it all. She was a hard taskmaster, that everybody would tell you that. She got her results. She left a love of good music, an appreciation of the arts.
Until she was about 7 years old, Dawson lived just north of Greensboro in the small town of Madison. Charlotte Museum of History CEO Terry White says all of Dawson's family members sang in the church choir, which was when her parents realized Dawson had exceptional talent.
They saved for years and years and years to send her off to Boston to study music at the New England Conservatory.
But opera companies wouldn't hire African-American performers, and so many talented black musicians turned to teaching. Dawson instead earned money by giving private piano and voice lessons to students in Pittsburgh, where she was living at the time.
In fact, the jazz pianist Amon Jamal studied under her, and it just goes to show how her influence spread across musical genres.
Yes, I love his music, and my understanding, he was a 7-year-old little boy when she was teaching him.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah.
And she was teaching piano lessons in this particular house. It was known as the Mystery Manor, I understand.
It was. So this home in Pittsburgh served as a place when Black entertainers, athletes, et cetera, weren't allowed to stay in the local hotels. They knew that they were welcome to stay at the Mystery Manor. And it was so called because you just never knew who was going to be there or what was really going on in there.
Lena Horne, Cab Calloway, Roberto Clemente, a list of who's who stayed at the Mystery Manor. It is where Dawson auditioned members for the choir she formed in the late 1930s, which performed nationally, including at the 1939 World's Fair in New York. With that success under her belt, Dawson forged ahead with her mission to create opportunities for Black musicians by establishing the National Negro Opera Company, using many of the vocalists in her choir.
The people who sang in this group would go on to be powerhouses in multiple musical genres, including opera, around the world. The thing that the company struggled with was funding. And throughout its 21-year reign, it was just a constant battle for fundraising and sponsors from the organizations that were already supporting institutions like the Met.
Because it was a Black opera company. And my understanding is that the first show she did in New York, it was financially, it was not a success, and many thought it would fold. But tell me about 2 years later, after founding the company in 1943, she had a big show in Washington, D.C.
She eventually moved the company, the operations of the company, from Pittsburgh to D.C. because her husband moved to D.C. for a job. But while in D.C., she wasn't permitted to bring her company into any of the established theaters. And so what she did is she outfitted barges with these massive, elaborate sets where the symphony was on there. There was a stage with a full production layout, and audiences would have their chairs and blankets on the shore of the Potomac while this barge is floating. Unfortunately, it rained for days straight. So the first night they had to cancel. Second night they had to cancel. So it really took a big financial hit to the company that the weather just did not cooperate with them.
It was important to her that her audiences be integrated.
I think it's something she struggled with because she would find theaters that would say, okay, you can come, but Negroes must be upstairs, or Negroes aren't allowed to buy tickets. Even within her company, although it was majority Black, she had white musicians and a white music director and would bring in non-Black people just as a way to show African Americans can compete and perform with all people in these high art forms.
Dawson died in 1962 of a heart attack. The exhibition, Open Wide the Door, looks at Dawson's life, but also the contributions of other African-American opera singers and musicians who have been overlooked.
This is something we as a people have always done, and we want to show that it's the people from rural North Carolina, middle of nowhere Tennessee, backwoods of Alabama, who went on to become these mega superstars. We also go into just opera as a genre and how it is not just a European music form. We talk about Asian opera and African opera and stuff like that. And people who through today have been influenced by this company, Robert McFerrin Sr., who his son is out still making music to this day. We
Bobby
talk
McFerrin.
About
yeah.
Carol Bryce, who went on to found an opera company of her own in Oklahoma. People who are still carrying on the tradition of what Mary Caldwell Dawson started 80 years ago.
Over the last decade, the U.S. has seen a wave of new plants that use fossil fuels to make plastics. A recent report found those plants have received billions in taxpayer subsidies, yet they routinely break environmental laws. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports that Shell's ethane cracker plant in Beaver County, Pennsylvania, was given more than $1 billion in tax breaks, yet violated its air pollution permit, even before it opened.
Rebecca Quigley's favorite spot in her house is a wraparound deck with a sweeping view of the town of Vanport. But these days, the view is dominated by something on the other side of the Ohio River, the Shell ethane cracker.
At nighttime, we call it Gotham City, because it lights up the sky and is, it just looks like a great big huge city over there.
The cracker was Pennsylvania's largest construction project since World War II. It's part of a wave of plants built to take advantage of plentiful natural gas from America's fracking boom. It turns ethane, a component of natural gas, into tiny plastic pellets, which are used to make products from plastic packaging to medical devices. But since it's opened, it's been a problem for Quigley. She's seen flaring, black smoke, and one time, a sweet odor permeating the valley.
There was a sweet odor of antifreeze or syrup smell odor that was in the air.
The plant may push Quigley and her husband out of Beaver County. They're planning on moving when he retires in 3 years. Quigley says part of her worries are concerns about air pollution and long-term health effects.
You know, obviously there's violations going on, so yeah, it does concern me. Not for myself as much as it does for, you know, my grandkids or my kids or my community.
Alexandra Shakevich of the Environmental Integrity Project says it's right for communities near these plants to worry.
They're major emitters of greenhouse gases and climate warming pollutants, as well as major emitters of pollutants that are dangerous to human health, toxic and hazardous air pollutants.
Shakevich is lead author of a new report that found many of the plastics plants built in the last decade, mostly on the Gulf Coast, are now breaking environmental laws, even as they receive billions in tax breaks.
We found that 94% of the plants that we looked at reported accidents or incidents, so-called emissions events. These are illegal upsets that occurred when a plant malfunctions, when there's a fire, an explosion.
The Shell plant in Beaver County is a case in point. It was built with a $1.65 billion tax credit from the state. Regulators have found the plant violated clean air laws 19 times since beginning operations 2 years ago and have fined it over $10 million since then. The plant has released harmful levels of volatile organic compounds, chemicals that contribute to asthma and other respiratory diseases, as well as benzene, a known carcinogen. Shell didn't respond to requests for comment on the Environmental Integrity Project's report, but some in the region say the tax credits were money well spent.
Shell cracker plant was one of the best things that happened to Steamfitters Local 449.
Ken Broadbent is business manager for the local Steamfitters Union in Pittsburgh. Union members from around the country made six figures building the plant. He says the region needed the plant and the jobs that came with it. And he believes the tax credits helped bring Shell's ethane cracker to the state.
Ohio and West Virginia and Pennsylvania were in the running for the cracker in a tri-state area, and we were able to beat them by attracting them with better tax credits. That's how the game's played, whether I like it or not.
Broadbent thinks Shell's air violations are part of the plant getting up and running and that they'll eventually go away. But Shakevich says communities shouldn't have to choose between jobs and the environment. She says the public shouldn't be subsidizing polluting facilities.
We think if companies can't obey the law, they shouldn't be getting taxpayer money. We would advocate for, in the future, that taxpayer subsidies be tied to environmental compliance.
So far, Pennsylvania has not imposed additional environmental requirements for companies receiving state subsidies. The state recently passed a new tax credit to attract fertilizer plants. The tax credit has employment and investment requirements, but none for complying with environmental laws. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
The Allegheny Front is based in Pittsburgh and reports environmental news. The Mountain Valley Pipeline connects natural gas terminals in West Virginia and Virginia. It's running years behind schedule and billions of dollars over budget, but it continues to edge toward completion. The company building the pipeline claims it will be finished by June. But as RadioAQ's Roxy Todd reports, some residents say their concerns about pollution and safety aren't being heard.
Since January 1st, there have been more than 40 citizen reports citing alleged pollution along the Mountain Valley Pipeline in Virginia. Radio IQ interviewed several people who filed complaints with the Department of Environmental Quality, or DEQ.
And DEQ tends to come after the fact, you know, something has recovered or subsided, and they'll say, well, it looks okay. It's been frustrating, to say the least.
He goes, well, you can't do a major construction like this without having some sediment in your creeks.
After we file pollution incident reports to DEQ, none of us ever hear back from anyone within these regulatory agencies.
That was Kelly Ferguson in Giles County and Teresa Red Terry and Kathy Chandler in Roanoke County. DEQ says it promptly investigates all reports, and in all of these 40 cases, inspectors found no evidence MVP had violated any laws. The agency said some temporary sediment and mud may occur from heavy construction. This doesn't give Donna Pitt reassurance that her community of Giles County is safe from long-term effects of this pipeline.
Every day, I drive past this. Every other week or so, I test water and see what it's done to this beautiful, pristine environment. And I'm sick, and I'm just furious. I'm furious at politics. It's almost like, well, we feel like we were sacrificed. Little old Appalachian town, what do they know?
On this day, Pitt points to a spring in Giles County that supplies drinking water to a family that lives in a lovely historic home from the 1800s. But in late January, their spring started spewing muddy water. Irina Kalos, spokesperson for DEQ, said the pollution was caused by MVP construction.
MVP determined that the sediment in the water is related to a bore pit that it has excavated.
2 weeks after the complaint was originally filed, DEQ closed this investigation. The landowner, who didn't want to be recorded, said MVP workers have visited several times, supplying them with drinking water. The company cleaned mud out from the spring and from their hot water tank, and the family has begun drinking the spring water again.
The fear is that it will happen again.
This is Kelly Ferguson. We heard from her earlier talking about complaints she and other residents have made to DEQ and how they never hear anything back from the agency. She's a community organizer with a group called Protect Our Water Heritage Rights. They point to this polluted spring as a warning. Much of the land in Giles County is vulnerable because it has so many underground caves and springs.
They didn't actually fix anything. They put Band-Aids over the situation and are hoping for the best, I guess.
A few miles from the spring, another incident occurred in mid-February at another MVP site. On a steep mountain, there was an apparent landslide. The site looks like a crack opened in a cliff.
There was a very large rock that had basically separated from the rest of the rock in that area and had slid at least a couple feet.
Crews have been at work with a large drill near the landslide, and Ferguson says their group believes MVP is trying to stabilize it with concrete and rebar. Radio IQ reached out to MVP for clarity on this site, as well as other concerns residents have, but the company did not respond. A spokesperson with the Federal Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration says their inspectors have visited the site of this landslide, but they didn't provide additional details. Back in the town of Newport, Kelly Ferguson sits in a small white gazebo beside a road that winds through a dozen small homes in this once pristine community.
And you don't see a pipeline like this going through a wealthy community. You see it going through poor Appalachia.
She admits that she's been losing sleep, worrying that there could be further disasters if gas is flowing through the pipeline. MVP has set their target date for that for June. In Newport, I'm Roxy Todd.
Flooding has always been a threat in Appalachia, but over the past few decades, severe floods have become more frequent. Nicholas Zegre is an associate professor of forest hydrology at West Virginia University. WVPB's Curtis Tate spoke with Zegre about why West Virginia in particular is so prone to flooding.
What makes West Virginia and Appalachia so vulnerable to severe, frequent floods?
When we think about floods, in particular in West Virginia, we have to think about them as two ways. One is what we call a riverine-based flood. So the larger rivers that flood when they spill over the stream, the riverbanks onto the floodplain, which of course are normally dry areas. And so when we look at flooding in West Virginia, we see that riverine flooding, there are hot spots in the eastern panhandle where we see a lot of that riverine flooding. And that's associated with like the Ridge and Valley, like, you know, the large rivers like the Potomac, that the Ridge and Valley topography kind of creates these really wide river valleys that provide a floodplain. And we certainly have that in other parts of the state. But when we think about like hot spots in the state, the eastern panhandle, the riverine flooding is a big problem. Okay. But the other type of flooding we're concerned about in West Virginia is flash flooding. And flash flooding can happen anywhere. It can happen certainly in our small streams and our heavily dissected, you know, headwater valleys where 85% of our streams in West Virginia are small streams. And of course, we know we have people living up and down just about every hollow in West Virginia. And so one perspective, we actually have two hotspots. We have a hotspot in the West Fork watershed, kind of in that Clarksburg, Bridgeport, Harrison County area. And then we also see a flash flooding hotspot kind of central to Kanawha and, what we refer to as kind of those southern coalfield counties. Now, that said, flash flooding and riverine flooding does happen everywhere throughout the state. But if we're thinking about, you know, a higher propensity for flash flooding or for riverine flooding, we do see these emerging trends on where there are a greater probability of them happening.
So, for example, in the 2016 flood disaster in southern West Virginia, was it more the second type?
When they started collecting stories of what the flood looked like, the 2016 flood looked like, and when from the community and the first responder perspectives, and then when we started looking at what the floods looked like from a hydrology perspective, what became clear was it was a different type of flood in different parts of the Greenbrier watershed. So around Richwood and Raynell, for example, that was more flash flood, a wall of water moving very, very quickly downslope. Whereas when you were in the White Sulphur Springs and kind of Lewisburg area, it was more of a riverine flood where the river level rose and kind of spilled over and filled the wider valley. And what's interesting, Curtis, is when you start thinking about where the damage was and vulnerability and also recovery, we saw very different damage and very different approaches to response and recovery in Raynell versus like White Sulphur Springs. And, you know, we can tie that back to the different types of floods. But I should say that in the case of the 2016 flood, there were a lot of flash floods that routed downstream that also contributed to the larger riverine flood. And so we can have multiple types of floods occurring in the same event, which is going to be related to the topography and the stream channel and what all that looks like.
What's driving the heavier rainfall?
Heavier rainfalls are the result of a warmer atmosphere. You know, we think of the atmosphere as like a balloon. And if you blow up the balloon in your house in January and it's warm inside your house, you know, the balloon is expanded. And if you walk outside in that cold winter day, that balloon is going to contract. I walk back inside to that warm house and the balloon's going to expand. So that's what's happening with warming temperatures in the atmosphere. With a warmer temperature, the atmosphere expands, which means it can store more water. But with warmer temperatures, there's more evaporation of water from our soils and our trees and our rivers and our lakes. And so more water is being put into the atmosphere and more of that water can be stored in the atmosphere. And once the atmosphere reaches saturation, we have these very heavy, intense rainfalls. And so heavy rainfall and air temperature is very clearly related. In fact, for a single 1 degree temperature increase, and 1 degree Fahrenheit increase in air temperature, the atmosphere can hold 4% more water. And so as the atmosphere warms, it holds more water and it creates more rainfall.
How much does land use, whether commercial, residential, or industrial, contribute to the problem?
Whether it is what we would call an old growth forest or a Walmart parking lot, if you drop 8 to 10 inches of rain in a couple of hours, like what was experienced in eastern Kentucky two summers ago, there's going to be flooding. Our systems just aren't designed to handle that much water. But land use activities very much affect how quickly water runs off. And so impervious surfaces associated with industrialization, associated with urbanization, and associated with, the result of surface mining. All of this routes water more quickly. More water is routed more quickly off that landscape. And so when we think about, how do we mitigate these effects of extreme rainfall and flooding, putting our landscape back into forests is a really important part of this conversation. But land use is a really important driver of flooding. But I should also say that it's really hard to detect the effects of like a single neighborhood or a single mine or a single, clear-cut parcel and the effect that that has on flooding. And so we often think about this, we know how water cycles through the atmosphere and through the earth. And so what happens when we remove forests and remove soils, that water can't be stored and that water is not removed from runoff. So all of that goes downstream.
That was Nicholas Zagre of the WVU Mountain Hydrology Laboratory, speaking with Curtis Tate. Till next time, thanks for joining us as we journey throughout Appalachia. Our theme music is by Matt Jackford. Other music this week was provided by John Blissard, John Ingram, Tim Bing, Jerry Milnes, Mary Hott, and Tyler Childers. Bill Lynch is our producer. Xander Alloy is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Eric Douglas. Kelly Libby is our editor. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Visit wvpublic.org/insideappalachia to subscribe or stream all of our stories. Or look for Inside Appalachia on your favorite podcast app. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University, focusing on students' futures. Classes available at concord.edu/apply.